The personality of Kali said. Yatra, anywhere. Kva, and everywhere. Va, either. Ata, thereof. Vatshami, I shall reside. Sarvabhauma, O Lord or Emperor of the earth. Tava, your. Agyaha, by the order. Lakshaye, I see. Tatra, tatra, anywhere and everywhere. Api, also. Twam, your majesty. Atta, taken over. Ishu, arrows. Shirasanam, bows. Translation. O your majesty, though I may live anywhere and everywhere under your order, I shall but see you with bow and arrows wherever I look. So you can repeat, O your majesty, though I may live anywhere and everywhere, under your order, I shall but see you with bow and arrows wherever I look. So purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. The personality of Kali could see that Maharaja Parikshit was the emperor of all lands all over the world, and thus anywhere he might live, he would have to meet with the same mood of the king. The personality of Kali was meant for mischief, and Maharaja Parikshit was meant for subduing all kinds of mischief mongers, especially the personality of Kali. It was better, therefore, for the personality of Kali to have been killed by the king then and there, instead of being killed elsewhere. He was, after all, a surrendered soul before the king, and it was for the king to do what was required. Okay. So, Kali Ravachi Yatra Kva Vata Vatsyami Sarva Boma Tavagya Lakshye Tatra Tatra Bi Tvam Ateshu Shara Sanam. So, Om Gana Timiranda Shah Ganan Jana Shlake Ajashu Meditam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurve Namaha. So there's several topics that are very interesting here, and some of them are even relevant to today's news. I mean, just like some of you who know or have been reading the news recently have seen how that certain governments are getting the phone records of everybody. Anybody read the news? No, nobody reads the news here. You're all Hare Krishna devotees. So there was a big big scandal recently, where it was found out that certain governments, and I'm not going to mention the names of the governments since I come from that particular country, certain governments have access to the phone records of everybody who's making phone calls. That is, they know who you are calling, maybe what you're talking about, who you're receiving phone calls from. So it's been a big thing in the media recently. Media means like newspapers or internet or like that. And so everybody is worried that the government is finding out what they're doing. Of course, the government ostensibly is doing this to curb down what's called terrorism. So, of course, the people don't want the government being aware of what they're doing. However, here you see in this verse that the king, Parikshit Maharaj, is actually aware of what all the citizens are doing. I wouldn't say at every moment, but at least of what they're doing in their lives, who they're interacting with. And this is for the principle of protecting religious principles in society. That's the king's duty. Now, you may say this is a little radical to say that the king is aware of whatever anyone is doing and who they're interacting with. Let me give you a practical example from the Ramayana. Ramayana, of course, is the story of Lord Rama. So Lord Rama, when he was the king or emperor, he would be sending out spies to spy on his citizens. to find out what they were talking about. And not only did he send out spies to spy on his citizens, he himself became a spy. What do I mean by that? He dressed up like an ordinary person, putting on a turban or ordinary clothes, and went out amongst the citizens to find out what they were saying about him. And the reason he was doing that was not so that he could stay in power. Lord Ram was definitely not attached to power. But the reason he was doing that was that he was concerned with the welfare of the citizens. He was concerned that they had the proper, let's say, respect for the government so he could carry out his duties. So therefore, he put on that disguise. And what he found when he was going out in disguise was that some of the citizens, particularly a washerman, was speaking negatively about him. And why was the washerman speaking negatively about him? Because this washerman had a little problem with his wife. I guess his wife came back late one night. It's not really stated what the wife was doing, but anyway, she had gone somewhere without the husband's permission. Of course, we cannot impose that same sort of restriction nowadays that the wife can't go anywhere without the husband's permission. But in the traditional Vedic times, it was like that. So anyway, so this washerman's wife had come back, and then he just rejected her. He said, "Get away. I don't want to see you anymore. Because you have violated the principle of chastity." And he said, "I am not like that Lord Ram." What did that Lord Ram do? He accepted his wife back after she had stayed for a long period of time in the house of another. And that other was, of course, the Rakshasa Ravan. And everybody knew that Sita Devi was chaste. I mean, there were many tests. Of course, Sita Devi never even came close to Ravan. And in fact, it wasn't even the real Sita that was with Ravan. It was the Maya Sita. And after the freeing of the Maya Sita or Sita from the clutches of Ravana, there was the entry into the fire. And Sita proved her chastity by coming out, being protected by the fire god, Agni. So really, there shouldn't have been any doubt in the chastity of Mother Sita, right? I mean, obviously, if you put your wife in the fire and she comes out, don't do that. Actually, it's very dangerous. And she comes out, you shouldn't have any more doubt in her. So, still, this washerman was having some doubt, and other people were talking like that. Lord Ram heard these doubts, and he thought, "How can I actually rule the kingdom if people have doubts in me?" Now, it's not that he was concerned with his false ego. You know, people have doubts in me, so therefore, how can I be happy if people don't love me? It wasn't a self-centered thing. It was simply out of duty. Just like Lord Chaitanya describes about a sannyasi. Sannyasi is like a white sheet. If it has any spots, people will talk about it. So Lord Chaitanya was very, very careful in his own behavior. So anyway, so Lord Ramchandra decided to banish Sita Devi. Very heart-wrenching story, isn't it? How he sent Sita Devi away. Not only did he send her away, but she was pregnant at that time. Very heavy story. Many of us, including myself, don't like that part of the Ramayana because it's just too heart-wrenching. Anyway, he sent her away and she was in the ashram of Valmiki Muni. So he was showing, which is the second topic of today's class, that the proper mood of a king is to consider the happiness, the welfare of the citizens as more important than his own happiness or his own welfare. That's the proper type of government. Now, we'll talk about different types of government in that regard. Of course, the type that Maharaj Parikshit was heading up and the type that Maharaj Yudhisthira was heading up and the type that Lord Ram was heading up, that they were Raja Rishis. It was a monarchy. A monarchy, but actually a monarchy controlled by religious principles and also by the brahmanas. So it's Varnashram system. The modern systems of government are nothing like that. I mean, let's take the most prominent, prevalent systems that are in the Western world. Let's take America, which I'm most familiar with. So it's supposedly a democracy. But let's describe what a democracy is anyway, so you can understand whether it's a democracy or not. An actual democracy is like they used to have in ancient Athens, where all the citizens, of course, what they call the free citizens, because most of the people who lived in Athens were actually slaves, captives from other countries, or, not to insult you women, but the women weren't allowed to vote. The women were considered like on the same level. So anyway, at least all the free citizens, they were allowed to vote. That's an actual democracy. And every day they would meet in the assembly and they would vote on different rules. And the problem with democracy, that type of democracy, is of course in Kali Yuga everyone is Shudra, Kalo Shudra Sambhavat, that every day the rules would change. Which keeps life kind of interesting anyway. If every day the laws change. Because of the whims of the people. What is a Shudra? A Shudra is a person in the mode of ignorance. And a Shudra is simply interested in instant sense gratification. Or avoidance of pain. Doesn't think so much of the future. You're just concerned with right now what pleases me. And even if you're going to, even materially, let's say even if you're going to get sick, let's say by smoking a cigarette, a Shudra's not concerned with that. It's just, right now that cigarette has given me some pleasure. I don't know what the pleasure is from a cigarette, but it's giving him some pleasure. Even though on the packages of the cigarette sometimes there's depicted cancers. Some countries they actually do that. A Shudra will still smoke it. Oh, it's all right. Trust no future. Eat, drink, and be merry. For tomorrow you may die, that's the Western system, or Charvaka Muni, beg, borrow, steal, get yourself some ghee. So that ancient system in Greece was a full democracy, and it was controlled by the Shudras. What you have nowadays is something called a representative democracy. Actually, it's not really a democracy, even a representative democracy, which I'm going to talk about in a second. It's that you have people who elect representatives. But actually, those representatives are not really selected by the people. They're selected by the business interests. Therefore, you have something called the modern system of government in most of the Western world is what we call plutocracy. The word plutocracy means, it's actually from Greek, which means the system by which the most influential members of society control the others. And that, of course, means the Vaishyas are running the government, right? The Vaishya government. Vaishyas mean the business interests. Of course, not real Vaishyas, because a real Vaishya is interested in what? Krishi Gorakshya Vanijam. Vaishya commerce with Bhavajam, as the Bhagavad Gita tells us. For cow protection and commerce. A real Vaishya would not be eating cows or eating meat, be protecting cows. So this is the system of governments that we generally have in the Western world, the plutocracy or plutocratic system, where business interests are controlling. Actually, there's one place in the Western world where you have almost a pure plutocracy, and that's in London. It's interesting, because London, I'll explain what I mean by that. London is a city where more people work than live. So the people who work or the business interests and people who work for the business interests actually are the majority of people who are voting in London rather than the people who reside there. So that's more of a plutocracy than practically speaking anywhere else. So then what you have when you have this plutocracy is that the business interests are interested in exploiting others. They have different systems of philosophies of government and actually economics, like trickle-down economics. I'm not going to get into this, all the details of this. Where what's good for the upper class is good for the lower class. And then they try to institute a system of taxation that is good for the upper class and, let's say, not so good for the lower class. And they try to minimize the amenities afforded by the government, like healthcare systems and everything. I'm speaking about America like that. like right now, there was some proposal to have universal health care in America. Not really universal, but something better than what we have now. And then the what's called the Republican Party, I think you know what I'm talking about. The Republican Party is the party of business interests. Of course, they're all business interests, but more business interests than the other business interests. So they're trying to negate that particular system of health care. So what you have in a country like America is that more money is being spent on health care than any other country, any other first world country per capita, and then you have one of the lowest one of the lowest common denominators of health in the country. You know, so it's interesting because the doctors are exploiting people. Doctors have become vicious instead of Brahmins as they traditionally were. And the government is exploiting people. And so it's pretty much what described in the Srimad Bhagavatam. The government will exploit the people. People will run to the forest and to run away from the taxation and the arrangements in society, so the people are just like sapped of their energy and made to work like slaves. So anyway, so that's the problem with the present systems of government. Of course, you have other systems like communism and you know, communist system, like promise of the communist system is a system of shudras. The shudras are in charge. Democracy means the vices are in charge. And then you have a so-called theocracy in certain countries, like Iran, where it's apparent, it seems like the religious people are in charge, but the religious people are actually vices and shudras. So it's not really a theocracy. So the Varnashram system is arranged so nicely that the Brahmanas are not the ones running the government. Because when you have the intellectual class, the spiritualists running the government, they become polluted. Even if they have all good intentions. Like Prabhupada gave this interesting statement one time. He said, if you go to Lanka, you become Ravana. And but in modern parlance, that means you've got a conflict of interest. So the Brahmanas were in a situation in the traditional Varnashram system where they had no conflicts of interest. In other words, they weren't taking a salary. As soon as you take a salary, you're maintained by someone, then you have a conflict of interest and you can't advise someone in a detached way. You're attached to your power. I mean, the typical example of a detached Brahman in a political situation would be Chanaka Pandit. Chanaka Pandit was the advisor of Maharaj Chandragupta. And when he disagreed with Maharaj Chandragupta, he wasn't worried about losing his salary. He simply left and went away. Of course, he became the enemy of his previous king because he stuck to his beliefs. So really what we need in society is the guidance of real Brahmanas. And a real Brahmana, as I said before, has to be detached from, let's say, from the control of anyone else. And that's done because a Brahmana accepts a vow of poverty. Not that he becomes poverty stricken, but he doesn't become dependent on any one person. He travels, he can travel, or he can get charity, but he's not getting salaries for what he's doing. Yajan, yajan, patan, patan, dana pratigraha. He can accept donations, he can give donations, he can teach, he can learn, he can show how to do sacrifices, or he can do sacrifices himself, but he's completely independent. Whatever happens, he's not controlled. So therefore, he can give advice to a saintly king like Yudhisthira Maharaj or Parikshit Maharaj, and the saintly king defers to the Brahmana's judgments. And we see this in the case of Lord Ramchandra, we see this in the case of Maharaj Yudhisthira, any great saintly king, that they defer to the judgment of the Brahmana. So, if a Brahmana is presented with the kingship, he'll refuse to accept. And he'll arrange for some proper person to become king. I'll give you a practical example of that in the Bhagavatam. Or they'll depose an improper king. There was this king, Vena Maharaj. Vena Maharaj was actually a rascal king. He was stopping sacrifices, declaring himself to be God, killing people unnecessarily, and therefore the Brahmanas deposed him by chanting certain mantras. Not that the Brahmanas got guns or rifles or anything like that, or the Brahmanas were so expert they could chant a mantra and kill someone. Fortunately, we don't have devotees like that nowadays. That'd be dangerous. Isn't it? You know, all of a sudden someone dies. So what the Brahmanas did, they killed this Venu Maharaj, and Venu died, and right after Venu died, there was no king. And because there was no king, the rogues and thieves, that's the problem with anarchy. That's another system or a non-system of government. Anarchy means there's no government. So the rogues and thieves were actually stealing, rioting, doing all sorts of things. So the Brahmanas thought, what should we do? But they didn't take power. They thought, we have to come up with a system of producing a king. So then they looked at Venu's body. And the Brahmanas then were so expert, even in medical practice. Nowadays we're so proud that we can do genetic engineering. You know, GMO food, GMO people. Actually, it's very prominent now that they're trying to revive extinct animals, like this woolly mammoth. You've heard about this? Woolly mammoth. They find the woolly mammoth in ice in Siberia and other places like that, and they take the genes and they splice them onto some other genes of an elephant or something like that, and put inside an elephant's. A lady elephant's womb, and they're going to come out with a woolly mammoth. So this is the modern scientists with the genetic engineering, or of course this is a little bit more sophisticated than what Hitler and other people were trying to do with eugenics. Eugenics means you try to breed someone or breed a race. So anyway, so the Brahmanas at that time, they knew how to do that. So they basically took Venu's genes. In the Bhagavatam, it's described as the process of churning. They took the genes and created another king from there. Of course, first they got rid of the bad genes. And the bad genes became this Bahuka. This, you know, low-class person. Bahuka means basically sit down or get out of here. Something like that. Sit down and behave yourself. Like you say to a child sometimes, sit down and behave yourself. So, and then they kept churning or working with the genes, and they came up with Prithu and Archie. Not only did they come up with a king, but they came up with a queen too, out of the same genes. Because another point is the Brahmanas were very concerned with breeding. They were concerned with eugenics. That is, having the proper children produced by a combination of a king or a prince and a princess, or a king and a queen. And the Brahmins also arranged marriages because they wanted someone. It's important when people got married to other people of the same quality, they developed a proper offspring. Otherwise, if you had a king, I mean, there was Venu's father, for example. Venu's father, Anga, he married the daughter of fear personified. So it was improper marriage. Because improper marriage means that the child will take after one of the two, the father or the mother. And the child took after the mother because the son sometimes, or generally, takes after the mother, as Prabhupada said. And that was where Vena came from. So the Brahmins would even, like, arrange marriages. Like you see in Lord Chaitanya's time, there was this Brahmana who arranged Lord Chaitanya's marriage. Lord Chaitanya called for the matchmaker, and the matchmaker Brahmana actually did that. So the Brahmanas had all these different duties in society. To guide the government, to provide medical care, to give psychological advice to people, to arrange marriages. So it was a Brahman-guided society. But the Brahmanas had nothing to gain from their activities. The only thing the Brahmanas gained was the pleasure of the Supreme Person. We've got it. So that's the sort of system that we need in order. And the Brahmanas, another point, just one other point. The Brahmanas couldn't become the king, not only because their consciousness would become contaminated, but because they just didn't have the courage of the king. You know, the king had to go there and be at the forefront of the battle. And the Brahmanas, naturally, they don't like pain. Of course, Shudras also don't like pain. But the Brahmanas, they don't like a painful situation. Here's a story that illustrates that. Once upon a time, there was this person named Karna, who was approaching Parashuram, the warrior incarnation of the Lord, to be his guru. Now, Parashuram didn't like to have Kshatriyas as his disciples. He really hated Kshatriyas. I mean, he killed them 21 times. 21 generations of Kshatriyas. He had this post-traumatic stress disorder because his father had been killed, right, by Kartavirya Arjuna. So he basically, whenever he saw a Kshatriya, he got angry. I mean, even he got angry at Lord Ram when Lord Ram broke the bow of Lord Shiva. Parashuram was ready to kill Lord Ram until he discovered that Lord Ram was actually Vishnu. So, Jai Shri Shri Radha and Arvika Giridhari. So, anyway. So, Parashuram had this problem with Kshatriyas. So, in order for Karna to take instruction from Parashuram, Karna had to make believe that he wasn't a Kshatriya. Alright. So, he was worshipping his guru and learning all these different weapons from his guru. And then one day, his guru was taking rest. Parashuram was taking rest. And Parashuram's head was on Karna's lap. But then what happened was this big bug. I mean, like a worm bug, like horrendous, like teeth and everything like that. Started crawling and eating, burrowing into Karna's leg. And Karna, what did he do? He didn't jump up like most of us would. I mean, just like this morning, I was taking a walk and there was a mosquito in my hand. And what did I do? It was an automatic reflex. Prabhupada said, you can kill a mosquito when he attacks. I mean, one time, Prabhupada was under a mosquito net and there was a mosquito inside and Shudakirti asked Prabhupada, can I kill him? And Prabhupada said, wait till he attacks. And as soon as he attacked, Prabhupada said, kill him! Because he's attacked. So anyway, so this came back to the story. So Parashuram, his head was on Karna's lap, and Karna was just tolerating this bug that was like burrowing into him, into his skin. Can you imagine that? I mean, I could never tolerate such a thing. And so then what happened? Is that some blood fell on Parashuram. Parashuram woke up and he said, you know, what's this blood? And Karna explained, and then Parashuram said, you're a Kshatriya. You're not a Brahmin. You're a Kshatriya. Because nobody else could tolerate this sort of pain. And you see, like Grandfather Bhishma, he was fighting the battle of Kurukshetra. And he had all these arrows in him that Arjuna was shooting. And he kept rushing at Arjuna, right? He didn't go, ow! I mean, you see in the battle of Kurukshetra, the Kshatriyas sometimes they get an arrow and they just pull it out. You know, can anyone here do that? You have an arrow stuck in you? I mean, even if even if I'm walking, if I hadn't cut my toenails and one toenail hits another toe, ow, you know, I have to stop and do something. I can't tolerate pain that well. Prabhupada said that's a quality of Brahman. So therefore, a Brahman is not good as a Kshatriya. He'd be what we call a wimp. You know what a wimp is? You know, can you imagine a Brahmana going out in the battlefield and just saying, please don't shoot those arrows at me. I'm hurt. I got a scratch on my hands. You know, come on. He wouldn't be very good. You know, Brahman has to just like be fearless. I mean, a Kshatriya has to be fearless like that. He's fearless, determination, battle, heroism. These are all the qualities ascribed to the Gita. So therefore, the Brahmana shouldn't take up the position of king, not only because his consciousness would get polluted having power. What do they say? Power corrupts absolute power. Corrupts absolutely. But because he's not really qualified. He can't do a good job, because the king has to be heroic, fearless, determined, ready to die, ready to stand in front of his army in the battlefield, not just sitting in some bunker somewhere, controlling everything with UAVs. You know what a UAV is? A drone. You know what a drone is? There's these planes they have nowadays. They're pilotless, controlled, radio controlled, and people can sit like 10,000 miles away and, you know, bomb the enemy just like sitting behind a computer with a, what they call a joystick, you know, a controller, and killing people. That's not Kshatriya. A Kshatriya, I mean, another story about Kshatriya the Prabhupada tells. So once upon a time there was a Kshatriya, and he did not defeat his enemy. He came back home, and his wife wouldn't let him back in the castle. He said, "It's me, dear." And she said, "Well, my husband would never come back without having defeated the enemy or being severely injured. You're not my husband." So, can you imagine? That's a Kshatriya woman. You know, women also have varnas. Sometimes people say that women don't have varnas, but women also have varnas. So she said, "Get out of here. You're not my husband. Get the hell back there and fight." So the guy fought and he won. And he came back, and she said, "You are my real husband." He gave him a hug. So anyway, Brahmana, so there has to be a clear distinction between the different varnas insofar as the system of governance and the system in society. The Brahmana's guide, Kshatriya's rule, Vaishya's trade, commerce, cow protection, and the Shudra's, that's another point. The Shudras also should not be getting salaries, because as soon as they get a salary, they get drunk. Or they spend it on prostitution or some ridiculous thing. But the government should definitely be headed up by martial men. You know, that means military. And I'm not speaking about a modern military government. But there is some benefit to that. Because then the criminals are afraid. I'll just tell one final story that illustrates that modern, with modern news. One of the countries I work in is Fiji. And a few years ago, they had a military coup. But the military governor, actually his name is Bani Narama. He has Rama in his name. So just by chanting his name, you get spiritual upliftment. So the military governor is actually, he's very religious, and he's guided by religious leaders, Christians and also Hindus in society. And he straightened up society really quickly. Because previously, it was a government really by the Shudras. It was a tribal government. You know, tribal means you have all these like Fijian natives there who are electing their chieftains. And the chieftains are just like really big, fat, intoxicated people who are controlling the government. So he overthrew that particular government and established a rule so that the criminals, instead of like having to hire a lawyer and, you know, getting off scot-free, as we say. The criminals were immediately punished. He would take the criminals, as soon as he caught them, to the army camp and make them run around naked and do exercise in the army camp. And the incidence of crime went down dramatically in the country because there was swift punishment. Instead of nowadays, as it's described in the Bhagavatam, if you have money and you can afford to hire a lawyer, then you don't get punished for a particular crime. I don't know if it's that way in this country. But most countries, it's like that. Western countries, it's like that. It's like who you know, who you are, and you don't get punished for a particular crime. So there we see the incidence. The modern instance is not really precisely Varnashram, because he's not a devotee. But a modern instance of a military leader who straightened up society. And he actually instituted equality for all races, whereas previously it was a racist society. But guess what happened? All the Western governments, includes Australia, New Zealand, and most of the EU, they actually condemned him for that. Because they're very attached to this idea of democracy, which is in fact a plutocracy controlled by the rich interests. And they become threatened when anything else occurs in the world. Anyway, a little bit of modern news. So, any questions or comments? But any of the points I made in class, you know, governmental points, spies, which I talked about in the beginning of class, how the government has to have, what? Yeah. Okay, question.
It sounds like you are...
oh.
accepting that spy thing, and you once mentioned that you were approached by the FBI to, or was it the CIA? Well, buy for them?
Yeah, well, I actually thought I would make some extra money by working for the FBI and spying on the Hare Krishna movement. That's what I meant. I'm not doing it, don't worry.
Are you
on? No, I'm not. No. I'm not doing it. But, you know, but they paid me enough, maybe. We talk about build some extra temples, you know, help support the movement. Because we have nothing to hide.
I hope you're joking.
We have nothing to hide, do we?
Maybe we do, maybe we don't, but...
I mean, I'm not doing
it. Knowledge can be abused, even if...
Yeah, yeah, good. I'm joking, of course. But with a proper government, we'd have no problem.
Where are those proper governments?
Yeah, that's the point. That was the point I was making. With a proper government, we'd have no problem with that.
No problem at all.
No problem. I mean, if it was Lord Ramchandra in charge, then we can have complete transparency. But because it's controlled by the business interests, and actually... You know, there's demoniac interests there. And, you know, one of the main business interests is cow slaughter and all sorts of interesting things like that, exploiting people. And the idea, you know, even you read papers nowadays about people coming up with plans to reduce the population by various nefarious means.
Absolutely.
So we're not trusting the modern governments, but hypothetically, I was presenting a hypothetical situation where you would actually have a proper government in charge, we wouldn't mind.
Totally agree.
We'd feel protected.
So the whole internet, Facebook, whatever, yeah, spying network is not so good because it's in the hands of the wrong
people. Yeah, it was in the hands of the right people would be fantastic.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm not saying that if Ravana is spying on me, I'd be happy about it. I mean... But actually, there's a fact that, talking about spies, here's more stories from the Ramayana about spies. Ravana actually sent people to spy, some of the Rakshasas to spy on Lord Ramchandra and the army once they crossed the ocean. And they took on the form of monkeys, these spies. Because Ravana's people could actually change, they had, was it a shape shifting? They could actually put on any form they wanted. So they took on the form of monkeys. And they were discovered by Vibhishan, because Vibhishan actually knew all the Rakshasa tricks. And then, interestingly enough, this is such an interesting story from the Ramayana, that they are brought before Lord Ram, and everyone wanted to kill them, because spies generally you want to kill. And Lord Ram said, no, show them around, let them see whatever they want to see. This is so that Ravana could be more fearful, because he wanted to scare Ravana. Because with all the... There were millions of, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of monkeys there. It wasn't just like the zoo here. You know, we have a few monkeys. It was like hundreds of millions of monkeys. And these are ferocious, gigantic monkeys. And he wanted to scare Ravana. So he said, show them around. And also, Lord Ram, he sent his spies over. And they knew everything Ravana was doing. Because Lord Ram's spies were the friends of Vibhishan. They were Rakshasas. And they could fly and disappear and be invisible and everything like that. So they were spying on Ravana. So you had spies on both sides. So spies is normal. That's a normal procedure. I mean, every government has to have spies. Isn't it? I mean, spying on the people and spying on your enemies. Yes. We've planted microphones in every room here. You don't know what we've done. So, no, I mean, actually the way we spy, actually I'm one of the GPC spies, but the way we do it is we know people who know different things. And they report. Yeah. Yeah, and actually it's proper, it's described. Any government has to have spies. And, except you're not supposed to get caught. You're not supposed to get caught. So it's all right. I mean, just like, what was the story that I, with a disciple? Oh yeah, we had one disciple somewhere, I'm not going to mention where, who we suspected was having an illicit life. And he just kept denying it. So I went to another disciple who worked for the phone company and got his text records. You can do that sometime. And then I saw that he was actually having an illicit affair. And so, kicked him out of the temple. So that happens sometimes. So you got a king or a leader just has to be aware of what's happening. Is that all right? Unfortunately, in ISKCON, we've mixed the brahmanas and the kshatriyas. That's another issue. So even though I'm a sannyasi, supposed to be a brahmana, then somehow or other, you know, I've got involved in kshatriya activities, and somehow or other I've gotten involved in vaishya activities, which creates a conflict of interest. So my proposal, which I made many times at the GBC, is that you have a division of labor. You have certain GBCs that are brahmanas and certain GBCs that are managing. And not that one is better than the other, it's just different. But every time I propose that, the members of the GBC who happen to be kshatriyas by nature, they say, "What do you mean? We're less. How can you say you're the brahmanas?" You know, they get upset and it never passes. But really, you need a division of labor. And ultimately, in ISKCON, we're going to have something like that. That's varnashram. You can't. It's too much of a conflict of interest. I mean, even in my own service, where I happen to be GBCer in charge of a particular yatra, and then also I have disciples there at the same time. I mean, when you're dealing with someone, it's a real conflict. What am I supposed to do? Act for their best interest? Or should I act for the interests of the yatra? And of course, I always defer to their best interest, and that makes me a lousy manager. So you can either be a lousy manager or a lousy brahmin. You got your choice. Right? You know, like devotees come up to me often. Even temple presidents, they come up and say, "Hey, preach to this person to do his service, to stay here and not go anywhere else." And I'm thinking, but it's not in his best interest. So what am I supposed to do? You understand what I mean? The conflict of interest that arises. Yeah, so you have a question?
So the GBC would manage to do this kind of arrangement.
Yeah.
It would be a tremendous encouragement to the devotees.
Yeah.
To see it happen, really. But since they are like, if there is some kind of conflict or disagreement, it's not likely to happen around in ISKCON.
It will in the future. I mean, I assure you it will. But it will take some time. I mean, the nice thing about having a Brahmin who has no financial or other interests is that you can go to that Brahmin for advice. See, that's one thing that's lacking to a large extent many temples in ISKCON, that if you go to someone for advice, he also has some managerial things to carry out. So you're wondering whether his advice is actually influenced by his management. You know, whether he wants you to do more RTs or whatever. So they would attract a lot of people. Many of the churches, of course, I don't know about the churches here in Sweden, but many of the churches in America, the minister or Brahmin, not a Brahmin, of course, but, you know, minister or priest, that has no control over the financial aspects of the temple or the church. There's a board of vaishyas or a board of businessmen who control it. And he just preaches and people go to him and, you know, ask for marital advice and things like that. And they feel secure in approaching such a person. I mean, even in my own service, you know, people approach me more for advice outside of my GBC zone than they do inside the GBC zone. Because they understand, here in Sweden, I'm completely detached. You know, whatever happens, you know, I'll advise according to what's best for the individual. And of course, I cooperate with the local people, or else they'll throw me out. But, you know, there's a cooperation. It's actually a two-way street. But where you have some managerial responsibility, it's a real conflict. Anyone else have any questions?
So is it possible to manage things without spies?
Without spies? Well, if you have enough electronic gadgets and cameras everywhere, yeah. Like right now in many of our temples, we have like cameras in every room of the temple. Not the bathrooms, but every room of the temple. I mean, right now, if I wanted to look at some of our temples, I could see every room in the temple, even using my mobile phone and the internet. So, is it possible to manage with us spies if you just had Brahmins? Yes. If the temple was just filled with Brahmins, you can have anarchy then. You don't even need a system of management, because everyone is very truthful, responsible, and everything like that. But when you have people with some propensities of Shudra or Vaishya, you got to have so many systems, like systems of accounts, accountability. Like that's why Prabhupada wanted like accounting, like people depositing money in the bank or certain signatures on checks, more than one signature on checks, because you know people had a tendency. I mean, when Prabhupada first started a temple, we got a temple in Hawaii. The temple president sold the temple and took the money and ran. You know, so if you just trust everybody completely, you're going to end up in trouble. I mean, this is practical. This is the material world. As much as we like to just, like, trust everybody implicitly, you have to have checks and balances. As they say, you know, in God we trust, everyone else pays cash. Did you ever hear that? And actually, there's a rule in the GBC now that anytime you have an agreement with someone that's more than like 1,000 euros, it has to be in writing. You know, it'd be nice just to have like implicit trust, but that's only available if everyone's a Brahmin. I mean, Kshatriyas also can be very tricky sometimes. They're not only always truthful. Kshatriyas have to engage in politics, you know, friends and enemy type of stuff. Isn't it? And you have to do that if you're going to be a Kshatriya. Hmm. Does that make sense? So Brahmaharaja Prabhu, you had another question?
Yeah. I've heard that Srila Prabhupada said that Brahmanas like anarchy.
Yeah, anarchy, right.
Is that correct?
For themselves, a Brahminical society, yeah. They like anarchy, but they understand it's not practical.
Oh.
Yeah.
Why do they like anarchy?
Because Brahmanas can be trusted. You know, a Brahmana is independent. You know, he doesn't want to have anyone else money in his life. It's just like, huh? Now, Kshatriya is also independent. But a Brahmana is extremely independent. You know, he'd rather be poor than have money and have his boss controlling him.
So then what is anarchy?
Anarchy means without a government.
The absence of a government.
Anarchy. I mean, like monarchy means the government controlled by a king. So anarchy, an means without a government. So a Brahminical society, I mean, let's say Satya Yuga didn't need a government. That's a Brahminical society because people are paramahamsas. Everybody's trustworthy. So yes, Brahman is naturally like anarchy. But they don't like it in the present situation because it would be a disaster. But if everything, all things being equal, you know, if everybody was trustworthy, Brahminical, sure, it'd be great. So that's a fact. And Brahmanas don't like to be told what to do. I mean, they really have a sense of autonomy. You know, no one's going to tell me what to do. So sannyasi is supposed to be like that too, but without any control. Of course, we accept control for the sake of spreading Krishna consciousness worldwide. It's not that sannyasis you just go anywhere without any coordination, but naturally that's the inclination, just to be able to travel freely and go anywhere. I mean, you don't find sannyasis like Madhavendra Puri being controlled by anybody, or even Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. You know, they just went where they felt like going. Yeah.
So they are controlled just under their gurus.
Yeah, well, they're controlled. That's another point. Brahmachari guru kulay vasandanda gurudham. A Brahman is trained, according to Prahlad Maharaj, goes to a guru kula, and he's trained to always work for the benefit of the guru, gurur hitam. So that's his control is like internalized. He doesn't need an external control. Whereas the shudras need external control. That's why I mentioned before, they don't get salary, because if they had salary, they'd just spend it on any sort of nonsense. And of course, everyone in Kali Yuga practically is shudra. So, therefore, they have to be controlled by others, by more severe means than the other classes. They're really controlled. Not slavery. We're not talking about slavery here. We're talking about control. Otherwise, they do things that are harmful for their own self-interest. So, any other questions? Yeah.
This whole concept of employment of devotees who serve in a temple is kind of strange, isn't it?
Yeah, Prabhupada didn't like it. You know, Prabhupada didn't like devotees getting salaries.
So, what is the best way to manage this in a legally accepted, you know, a system accepted by the local tax authorities?
Well, you have the devotees given something in kind. In kind means not money, but they would be given, you know, a house to live in or something like that. Rather than a salary. Of course, in America, practically all the religious people get salaries.
They do.
And the Catholic Church also.
Oh.
I was just reading about how a priest gets like, I mean, it's amazing, I wish I had that salary. A priest, he gets like 50 or 60 thousand dollars, you know, a little less in Europe.
How is it in the temples in America?
Yeah.
Primarily. Are they employed or?
If you have New Vrindavan, yes. And they're paying social security taxes and everything like that.
Not everywhere.
Not everywhere. It's sort of a mixed.
What's the alternative? The alternative
is that, well, there's two alternatives. One alternative is that you have no one living in the temple and everyone volunteers from the congregation, which is done in Houston, Texas. That's actually the dynamic that's there.
There's nobody there.
No.
Permanent.
Nobody permanent.
Single.
No.
How can
you agree with that? Well, what Tamal Krishnamurti arranged was that people formed a whole community and bought houses around there. So it's practically all volunteer deity worship. I mean, there's one head pujari.
Okay.
But he's a retired person.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, that's an alternative. And the Mormon Church has that particular dynamic, too.
And what's the other alternative? The
other alternative is you just provide the means for people to live. In other words, you give them a place to live, you give them prasadam, you may give them some spending money, or you may... It's a little too much to buy people's toothpaste for them. I think that's a little far out. But you give them some pocket money, but they buy the money and it's the temple accounts that are going through that is responsible. Rather than you give them a salary... You give them spending money, but the spending money is spent out of the temple account.
And then there's no social security.
No, there's no social security then. In other words, what happens when the person gets older and the temple doesn't need them anymore? That's another issue that has to be addressed.
Because then there is social responsibility of the temple.
Yeah, they haven't paid the social security money, so they're not going to get social security later on. Unless they're disabled, and anyway, they'll get disability money. Whether they paid or not. So that's a big... Actually, my mother was just speaking to me about that in New York. She was saying... she said, now when you get older, since you haven't paid Social Security, because I haven't, who's going to take care of you? And of course, I just told her, you will, Mom. Which is true, because... Anyway, she has enough means, even when she passes away. There'll be a trust fund, so I'm not worried about it. So, and also as a sannyasi and guru, you got people who are happy to take care of you. But for the ordinary devotees, it's a question that has to be answered. You know, how to take care of the devotees as they get older, you know, hospice, things like that. One of my godbrothers just recently, not recently, about 2 or 3 years ago, he had got Parkinson's disease. And he had to be taken to a extended care facility, which is very bad because there's no devotees around. He's surrounded, it's like, the place looks like the living dead. I don't know if you've ever seen an extended care facility. And everyone's just like drooling, like that, you know, half open eyes, and then the smell of urine everywhere. hellish. It's a hellish place. And so there wasn't enough facility to take care of him in the temple. So finally, devotees and myself arranged to raise money to send him to, because he's getting ready to pass away now, send him to the hospice in Vrindavan, which is arranged by Giriraj Maharaj. And so the hospice wanted too much money, so we had to negotiate, you know, half price for him, because he's an older Prabhupada disciple who served for so many years. But it was a real problem, because ISKCON doesn't have the resources to take care of it. And we don't have those resources right now. Even if we wanted to or had that proper social system, it just economically we can't do it. So how do you do it? I mean, in the long term, I prefer the system where you have retired congregation doing the deity worship and everything. It seems economically much more sustainable. You know, older devotees or devotees who have their own financial means doing that. And in one of the temples I'm in charge of, we're trying to go to that particular system right now and not have so many people living in the temple. It's a good question. Yeah.
What Prabhupada was saying about it?
Long term? I can't remember Prabhupada actually talking long term about how the temples would go on, but Prabhupada did talk about how Varnashram was the one part of his movement that wasn't instituted. He said 50% of my movement or 50% of my plans have not been instituted because I have not instituted Varnashram. You know, so Varnashram means a division of labor, which naturally means that some people are Vaishya inclined. And they'll be making money. They're the stomach of society. In the beginning days, of course, we shoved everybody in the temple, whether they were Vaishya, Shudra, Brahmin, or Kshatriya, and gave everyone a Brahmin thread, even if they were Shudras. And that's not, long term, that's not a good dynamic to have. Because you have people representing the movement who are basically Shudra by inclination. They think they're priests, but they're actually Shudras. Which is not, I'm not trying to criticize anyone, it's just their nature. So it's in the long term, it doesn't work. In any movement, you start like that, like Prabhupada started. Like if you look at the sociology of religious societies, they always start as charismatic movements where everybody just like surrenders their lives regardless. With Lord Jesus said, instead of being a fisherman, you become a fisher of men. You know. So in other words, he got everybody together, no matter what their varna was, and got them working as full-time preachers. But long-term, you have to break up into different varnas, and the movement can't continue in a charismatic way. It's called the post-charismatic phase. I mean, if you read the sociology of religion, there's many, many studies about this. So our movement has to go through many phases. And that's what we're doing. Right now, we're transitioning to more of a congregationally based society.
We're definitely in a post-charismatic phase.
Yeah. Yeah, but we still have a lot of people trying to be charismatic.
Yes.
But it's really not the right time for that. Because we have to do something called the institutionalization of charisma. In other words, that charisma resides within Prabhupada's society because Prabhupada is manifest through his society. And that's the phase that we have to go through right now. But, you know, you find that charismatic personality starts a movement, and then his initial followers try to imitate him. But it really doesn't work out that well. This happens in every single society. It's really interesting. And ISKCON has not been different in that regard. We actually had, you know, some of us, including myself, we try to imitate. But it doesn't work, because we don't have the same stature as Prabhupada. And then ultimately there's dysfunction because of that. But that's natural. And then after that you realize, well, maybe that doesn't work, so instead we have to concentrate on Prabhupada, Prabhupada's books, you know, Prabhupada's teachings, Prabhupada's example. And that is the long-term recipe for success for our society, if we can do that. But if you just remain in the charismatic phase, the whole thing falls apart. It just falls apart. Because then you're dependent on charisma, then it breaks apart like the Gaudiya Math. That's what happened with the Gaudiya Math. They were dependent on the charisma of Indra, so they all broke up into different maths with all their different acharyas. and finished. We don't want that. I was explaining to one of my godbrothers who left ISKCON and made his own mark. I said, you know, you may be doing nicely now, but what's going to happen when you leave your body? Everything you work for is going to fall apart. Whereas I know that everything I'm working for will continue. You know, because the movement is there. Like if I have a temple I'm in charge of, if I croak, I don't mean to die. If I die today, the temple will go on, right? Okay, I think we have to end now.
I have to go to a meeting, you have to go to a school meeting.
And I think all of us have to eat prasadam too.
Oh, okay.
All glories to His divine grace, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, He died.